Okay.
Is it on?
Yes. Okay. So let us continue. And I'm going to look at a couple of more suttas by way of background to the Noble Eightfold Path. These are more like general statements about the Noble Eightfold Path to understand kind of a little bit more of the broad picture here. And this next sutta we're going to have a look at is a very well-known sutta. It's from the Majjhima Nikaya, number 22, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. This sutta is called the Simile of the Snake, and it's famous for its two similes, two very well-known similes, one which is the simile of the raft, which you probably many of you will have heard of before. It's the raft as the idea of crossing over samsara and reaching nibbana on the other side. And of course, the raft is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, and this is why this is kind of relevant to what we're doing now. And also, there's just very interesting similes because they're often quoted and often, I think, also misunderstood. So it's useful to have a look at these similes and to kind of get to terms with them and see what they're really about. So the simile of the snake, Majjhima Nikaya number 22, Alla Gad Upama Sutta. It's always useful to know the Pali terms. You can really impress people if you know the Pali names of these suttas. Yeah? If you go around saying, Alla Gad Upama Sutta, that's my favorite sutta, people will think, whoa. So anyway, let's see what this has to say. Here, this is what the Buddha has to say. Here, some misguided men learn the Dhamma, the discourses, stanzas, expositions, verses, exclamations, sayings, birth stories, marvels, and answer to questions. But having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Instead, they learn the Dhamma only for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates. And they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learned the Dhamma. Those teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of those teachings. So this is, I think, a nice little explanation again for the purpose of the Dhamma, how to use it in the right way. The Buddha starts off here with talking about the various types of suttas that you find, you learn the Dhamma. It's quite an interesting list there of 9 different types of suttas, if you wish. The discourses, stanzas, and all these kind of things. And this kind of listing is found throughout the suttas, and it seems to be almost like an early way of classifying the suttas, classified according to these particular categories. And there's kind of some interesting historical developments perhaps there that you can find when you read these things, that historically maybe there were only a few of these categories and they expanded over time. For example, some of these that you see here, you have, for example, exclamations. Exclamations is the Udana. The Udana is one of the books of the Tipitaka, yeah, of the Sutta Pitaka, the Udana. Exclamations is translated as here. Sayings, this is the Iti Vuttaka. Iti Vuttaka, iti means thus. Vuttaka means said. Yeah, thus said, or thus saying. Birth stories, this is the Jatakas. Marvels, this is the, what is the marvels? Iddiharya or something like that. What is it here? what is it again? Acharya Buddha, perhaps. Acharya Buddha, I think it is. Answers to questions, Vedala. So this is kind of a late expansion. And you see how we started off with the discourses and the stanzas, which basically are verses. And gradually over time, it expanded and became a fairly broad range of different suttas. In other schools of Buddhism, you have even more of these. You have 12 rather than 9 categories. So it expanded even more in some later schools. So that list itself is quite interesting, and there is a lot of discussion in the kind of among academics and also Buddhist monks and people who are knowledgeable about this area, about what actually is the original number of categories that was used by the Buddha. So that is what you learn. Yeah, you learn those things, and learning here means learning by heart. Then it says having learn the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. In other words, all they do is they learn the teachings. Yeah, they learn the suttas. They can recite them to you, and it's very quite impressive when somebody recites Pali in long things. You know, like Satipatthana Sutta. If you're gonna recite the entire Satipatthana Sutta, it takes about 2 hours or something. Yeah. Why does it take so long? Because if you read the Satipatthana Sutta in Pali, you see all these little dots, And if you didn't have all those dots there, it would take up like a big volume to, you know, the whole Satipatthana Sutta, because there's so much repetition in some of these suttas. They're actually very large. If you want to, there's one very famous book of the Abhidhamma called the Patthana, and it's also full of dots. And they said that if you took out all the dots of the Patthana and you filled in all the gaps, the back of the book, the spine of the book, would be so long that it would reach from Sydney to Melbourne. That's the size. That's the spine of the book, and not the page, but the spine of the book would be that long. So this is kind of how, so that's obviously an artificial creation. Nobody can possibly say this kind of book, because if you were to speak it, you would have to be reborn a billion times before you could finish it, and that's kind of impractical if you want to remember the Dhamma. So you learn these things by heart, and it's astonishing how even in the present day you go to places like Burma and you find what they call Tipitaka masters. People are able to memorize the entire Tipitaka by heart. Yeah, and they will recite it for you, the Tipitaka, and you will stop them and you will say, start at exactly this point, and they will start at exactly that point and continue reciting. Yeah, very impressive when you hear that. But that's not enough. Yeah, that's only the beginning here. The important part is not that. The important part is then what you do with that, how you actually think about it. The idea of examining the meaning of the teachings is what really matters. What does it mean to you? How does it apply to your life? How do you apply these teachings in your particular case? What are your problems? What are the things that you have to do to move forward on the path? So you reflect on these teachings. And this is one of the things that I would recommend you to do if you feel, over your 9 days here, there's many different ways of practicing meditation. Sometimes it's nice just to reflect on the teachings. And if you find that comes naturally to you, it can be very useful to think about these things. Yeah, maybe have the sheets with you. If you have the sheets, have a look at them. What does this actually mean? And as you do that, it sinks in to a deeper level. And that's when they start to become really meaningful. The purpose of the Dhamma is not just intellectual understanding. It's not just the idea of knowing the actual wording of these teachings. But when they go deep inside, they actually start to become emotionally powerful. Yeah, when you start to feel these teachings, they become tangible, you feel inspired by them. Inspiration is an emotional state. Yeah, inspiration comes from understanding, but it's also a very powerful emotion. And it is these kind of emotions that actually enable you to go forward on the path, that drive you forward when you feel inspired by these teachings. So emotions are so important in Buddhism. It's not just about knowledge. It's not just about... that's only the beginning, and then the emotions comes afterwards. And that is what enables you to practice properly. And this is what we'll be talking about this morning, when we talk about the mind becoming placid, gaining confidence, becoming inspired. And that is really where the Dhamma is heading ultimately. And when you reflect on the Dhamma in the right way, when you become a stream enterer, if you're not a stream enterer already, that's okay. But when you become a stream enterer, you will then, just all you have to do sometimes is to remember the Dhamma. That gives so much joy to you, so much happiness. The more deeply you understand these things, the more powerful it becomes, and it starts to have a very strong impact on you. And this is what this is about. So you reflect on them, you gain a reflective acceptance of them. Yeah, you start to see these things are true. Blimey, this is true. Wow, this is actually the path to happiness. This is what I have to do with my life. This is the meaning of life. What else should I be doing except practicing these teachings? And of course, once you understand what these things are about, that these things are the very essence of what life is about happiness, overcoming suffering, of course, that really drives you forward. It becomes very important. You realize that there is nothing really else quite like it. But you need to go through that reflective acceptance. You need to practice it to some extent to be able to see that they actually work for you. And then it starts to come together very powerfully. But this is exactly what this person does not do. Yeah, they don't do that reflecting. And instead of doing that, they end up arguing and criticizing. You don't understand anything. You fool. Your teaching is wrong. Mine is right. You haven't got a clue what you're talking about. But there is a nice little passage in the suttas where they actually says things like that, yeah? I have refuted your doctrine. Go and save your doctrine if you can. This is how they were talking to each other. I think the Indians, they really liked a little bit of dispute and argument and debate. They seem to really, I'm not sure if that's still the case today, but certainly 2,500 years ago, they were really into this. But it's the wrong way, because very often what happens if you use these things, of course, a little bit of discussion is good. If you have an honest questions about things, that is always very useful. But if you use it for dispute, then essentially what you are doing is that you are, you know, why do we want to dispute about things? Very often it's ego-driven, it's driven by defilements, driven by problems of the, you know, by wanting to prove ourselves or whatever it is. And that is exactly the opposite of what the Dhamma is about. The Dhamma is about reducing the ego, becoming a bit more humble, more open-minded, opening up your heart, not about kind of, you know, proving ourselves in debate. And so this is where you go wrong. So if you do that, you actually create, obviously, bad karma as a consequence instead of moving forward on the path. So please don't grasp these teachings properly. If other people want to argue with you, just shrug your shoulders and say that's their problem. No need to argue. What matters is the inspiration instead. So what? Then you have the simile. Suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or its tail. It would turn back on him and bite his hand or his arm or one of his limbs. And because of that, he would come to death or deadly suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, here some misguided men learn the Dhamma, etc., etc. Why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of those teachings. And it's interesting here. Here the Dhamma is compared to a snake, in a sense. If you grasp the snake in the bad way, it comes back to bite you. And of course, the point is that the Dhamma, being such a powerful teaching, because it has the ability to do so much good, if you actually abuse them and use them in the wrong way, they can also have a very negative effect at the same time. If you use these beautiful teachings in the exact opposite way of how they're supposed to be used, they will actually have also the opposite effect. Yeah, so it's good to remember that. There's the potential here for making bad karma. The Dhamma turns back and bites you as a snake would bite you. And then we have the right way of looking at these teachings. Here some clansmen learn the Dhamma, the discourses, etc., answers to questions. And having learned the Dhamma, they examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they gain a reflective acceptance of them. They do not learn the Dhamma for the sake of criticizing others or for winning in debates, and they experience the good for the sake of which they learned the Dhamma. Those teachings, being rightly grasped by them, conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Why is that? Because of the right grasp of those teachings. So here you are doing what you're supposed to do. And again, this is so, when you know some of the suttas, how they talk about the Dhamma, how they actually show you how the Dhamma, understanding the Dhamma, meeting the Buddha is the foundation for the whole practice. You understand what is going on here. You learn the Dhamma, and because you are investigating it, you gain a reflective acceptance of it. Your confidence and your faith becomes very powerful as a consequence of that. And then when your confidence and faith becomes very powerful, that is the driving force, the motivation that drives you forward on the path. And there's this beautiful sequence, which I haven't actually got in the suttas this time around, which shows you how starting simply by learning the suttas, that's the only thing you have to do, doing that. And then from that, stage by stage by stage, you go all the way to awakening. So as long as you have the right attitude towards them, you learn them for the sake of your benefit, for the sake of your happiness, and also for the sake of happiness of others. As long as you have the right attitude, that is the outcome. These teachings will lead you to awakening. Why is that? Because you get brainwashed. Yeah, that's why. Gradual brainwashing. It's good to be brainwashed because you have to be brainwashed anyway. So make sure you get the right brainwashing. This is what this is about. Yeah, the Buddhist brainwashing, the best brainwashing. All other brainwashing is not so good. So get the right brainwashing. It's like getting the right soap powder in your washing machine. Yeah, get the one that works really well. So, and it's actually a very nice simile because it drives home the idea of non-self, yeah, that we are conditioned. This is what it drives home. And this is what is the point here. And it's a very beautiful simile that that actually what the Buddha explains this idea, that when you learn the teachings, you see the saparisas, the noble people, those who have insight, full insight into the teachings, then you hear the teachings from them, then you gain the faith and confidence, then you have the wise attention, from the wise attention you have the clear comprehension, the satisampajanya, from the satisampajanya you have the sense restraint. It's quite an unusual sequence. From the sense restraint, you have the three kinds of good conduct. Then from the three kinds of good conduct, you have the four satipatthanas. From the four satipatthanas, you have the seven factors of awakening. And from the seven factors of awakening, you have vijja, vimutti, liberation. And liberation and vijja, which is like true insight. Yeah. And then the Buddha says, this sequence, starting from the beginning, starting by just hanging out with the Buddha, hanging around with the people who are the saparisas, those people who have true insight. If you do that, this happens as an automatic process. He says it's like the rain on the mountaintop. When it rains on the mountaintop and rains and rains and rains and rains, yeah, this is like reading the suttas, then those gradually that rain forms into little streams. Yeah, the little streams forms into larger streams. The larger streams go into the little lakes. The little lakes go into the larger lakes. The larger lakes go into the large rivers. And the large rivers empty out and fill up the ocean. As long as it keeps on raining on that mountaintop, as long as it keeps on raining day after day, week in, week out, year in, year out, eventually that rain will reach the ocean and will fill up the ocean. In exactly the same way, as long as you keep on raining with the Dhamma, raining with the suttas, yeah? Raining with the suttas, like this, getting wet. Then gradually it will seep in. It goes through the skull and it seeps into your mind as a consequence. So as long as you keep on doing that, these things will eventually happen as a consequence. Yeah? So it's a very beautiful and powerful thing here. That actually goes on as you read the suttas, as you allow yourself to be conditioned by these beautiful teachings. But you have to grasp them the right way. Don't grasp them by the tail, because they will come back and bite you. How then should we grasp them? And this is what the simile is about that comes up now. Suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and caught it rightly with a cleft stick, and having done so, grasped it rightly by the neck, then although the snake might wrap its coils around his arm or hand or his limbs, still he would not come to death or deadly suffering because of that. Why is that? Because of his right grasp of the snake. So too, here's some clansmen. Clansman is the Kulaputta, it means like the son of a good family, that's really what it means, like son of a good family. Learn the Dhamma, learn all the aspects of Dhamma, and etc., etc. Why is that? Because of the right grasp of the teachings. So do grasp the teachings rightly, and if you do so, there will be a tremendous benefit for you. This is what the Buddha is saying here. Conducive to your welfare and happiness for a long time, and also the people around you, obviously. So, that is this famous simile of the snake. And then the Buddha says, therefore, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask either me about it or those monks who are wise, or those nuns who are wise, and even the lay people who are wise. Anyone who is truly wise, you can ask. That is how you do it. So again, this doesn't mean that we should never question. It doesn't mean we should never be critical. It means that we should be reasonable with our criticism and reasonable with our questioning. That's really what it means. Okay, now we come to the other famous simile. This is the simile of the raft, and this is how it goes. Suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear, but there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Then he thought, there is this great expanse of water, whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear, but there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then, when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head and load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now what do you think, monks? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done by, with that raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with that raft? Here, when that man got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land and set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now it is by doing so that that man would be doing what should be done with that raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. So this is another, I think, very interesting simile. It's a simile that you're very likely to have heard if you've been around Buddhist circles for a long time. It's very famous, and it's also very easy to misconstrue and misunderstand what this simile actually is about. But just to start off here and look at the, you know, the what the simile is really saying. And of course, the simile here is that the raft, of course, it is not actually said specifically here, but the raft is really the Dhamma. It is the Eightfold Path. And this is why it fits in with the theme of this retreat. That is what actually takes you ashore, takes you across. And then you have the idea of the near shore, which is dangerous and fearful. Yeah, the near shore is like, what is that? Well, it's like the sensual realm. Yeah, it's where we kind of are now. It is dangerous. You never know what's going to happen next. You're going to die. You're going to suffer. You're going to have problems. You never know where your next rebirth is going to be, etc., etc. So the near shore is kind of not very safe. And then you decide that actually maybe I should get off this shore and go to the other shore. But there is no ferry boat or bridge. And what is that ferry boat or bridge? Well, it would be like almost like an easy way of getting across. Yeah, in Buddhism, unfortunately, there is no easy way. So if you want an easy way, you've got to find a different religion. Yeah, no easy way in Buddhism. You've got to do it yourself. This is what the Buddha says. He says that, you know, I am here to point out the way, but you yourself have to do it, make the effort to get across to the other shore. If you want the easy way, you have to go somewhere else where the God says, okay, I will kind of help you across, and I will put you on the other side. But maybe that path is not as safe as the Buddhist path. And that's where the problem arises. And that reminds me of one of my stories. And my father told me this story. And this is kind of, it kind of fits in very well here, because my father, he was a businessman. He traveled lots all over the world, and, you know, also lots in Asia when he was in business a long time ago now, because after I became a monk, he was thinking, wait a minute, maybe I should kind of, do a little bit less, yeah? My son is becoming a monk. Maybe I should also kind of, you know, step down a little bit instead of working so much. So it has a really good effect on your parents when you become a monk, yeah? That's what happened in my case. So, but before that, before I was a monk, he was traveling everywhere, Japan, and this will happen to be to Malaysia. And he traveled to Malaysia, and he They were having a dinner together, doing some kind of business deal. And my father was in the shipping business, doing some kind of business deal. And then there was this Malaysian woman sitting next to him. She was some kind of businesswoman. And then they talked, obviously. And then she told him that she had converted from Buddhism to Christianity. Yeah, this is what you see sometimes, sometimes happens. And then my father asked her, why? Yeah, and she said to my father, she said, Christianity is a much better deal. Yeah, that she was a businesswoman. She wanted good deals. Yeah. Why is it a better deal? Because it's easier. It's like the ferryman. The ferryman takes you across, plonks you on the other side, and you're done. Yeah, you just pray to God, and God says, okay, now you can sit on my right-hand side. But what if it isn't like that? What if that is an illusion? What is that? It's just a kind of a nice idea. Yeah, and this is the problem. The easy way is often too easy. And that's part of the problem of the easy way here. And I think in part here, what the Buddha probably is criticizing, perhaps, is some of the ideas that were current in India at that time. You just pray to a certain god. You do certain things, and that those gods will then help you to kind of move you in the right position. The problem is that those gods are often just as deluded as you are. They don't really know anything. Yeah, they may be bright and fancy and all these kind of things, but actually, they haven't got a clue what's really going on. So you kind of place your future into the hands of somebody who doesn't know. That's always very problematic. So I think this may be part of what the Buddha is getting to here. There is no easy way. If you're going to do it, you're going to have to do it yourself. And there's something very beautiful about that. I always thought that there's always something very unfortunate with placing your fate into the hands of some unknown philosophy or unknown being, like a creator god or whatever. You don't know whether that creator god has your good at heart. Yeah, what if they haven't? What if the creator god isn't so nice? What if they have some kind of dodgy dealings on the side or whatever? Yeah, you don't know what they like, these gods. Sometimes when you read the Bible, you think, jeepers, I don't want to be in the hands of a god like that. They've done some really kind of, dodgy stuff. You just don't know, yeah, if you do that. And there's something very powerful about taking your own fate into your own hands. In the beginning, it's kind of scary because you feel so small and the world feels so large and the world is so scary. You don't know what's really going on. But once you start to get used to the idea, it actually empowers you. It empowers you to live well, to do the right thing, to be the creator of your own happiness, to help you to overcome suffering. You become the creator of your own life. And actually, it is a far better solution to the whole problem of suffering than kind of giving your fate into the hand of some unknown quantity. Yeah, so it's a bit scary to begin with, and it's actually very liberating when you start thinking about it. There's this beautiful Ratapala Sutta, which I often like to read out on retreats, but not on this one. And then the Buddha says there is no abhisara. Abhisara means like Lord. Yeah, there is no abhisara, there is no shelter. There's no way you can go to actually shelter from the world. There's nobody there who can kind of take over your life and look after you and sort you out. You have to take that responsibility yourself. That is what that is about. And a similar kind of thing right here. Then you bind together this raft. Yes, and this is like you start practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. And as you practice all the various factors of that path, that is how you basically bind it together, one factor after the other one. And eventually, as you do so, you cross over the stream using that Eightfold Path. And then when you come to the other side, what do you do with that Eightfold Path? You let it be. You don't grasp onto it. You don't carry it with you. Yeah, just like the raft here. So what does it mean not to grasp, grasp onto the Noble Eightfold Path? What actually is the idea behind this? And this is an important point of Dhamma to understand what this means, because the idea of Dhamma, the idea of attachment, the idea of grasping onto things, is that when, as an ordinary person, before you reach enlightenment and all these kind of things, and for most people, enlightenment is kind of fairly long way off, usually. So before you get there, some degree of attachment is required.
Yeah, and I should actually read out the very last sentence of the sutta here before I say anything more about that. When you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the teachings. In other words, even the Dhamma. How much more so things contrary to the teachings? So the idea here is that because attachment is a natural expression of the sense of self, yeah, as long as you have a sense of self, as long as you're not an arahant, you're going to have to attach, because that is what the sense of self does. It's like a hand. There's a beautiful symbol in the suttas of a hand. If you have a hand, the hand always grasps things. That's the nature of a hand. If you want to stop grasping, what you have to do is cut off the hand. It's the only way to do it. Yeah. In the same way, as long as you have a self, the nature of the sense of self is to grasp onto things. The only way you're going to be able to stop grasping is by actually seeing through the sense of self, seeing it as an illusion. Before you see it as an illusion, you have to grasp. And because you have to grasp, you have to choose your grasping wisely. Yes, the very first thing, therefore, the Buddha says is here to abandon the bad teachings, abandon the bad brainwashing. Yeah, there's lots of bad brainwashing going on. So abandon the bad stuff, but then grasp on to the good stuff instead. Grasp on to the Noble Eightfold Path. Grasp on to kindness. Grasp on to generosity. Grasp on to compassion. Grasp a little bit onto the suttas. It's not possible to let go of everything. You can't do it. So you just have to choose the right kind of grasping. And as you do that, as you grasp on slightly, you grasp on, if you like, stage by stage, higher and higher, as you move on to the Noble Eightfold Path, yeah, to higher and higher dhammas, higher and higher qualities, and you hold them lightly as you move up the path. It is necessary. You can't just let go of everything in one go. But eventually, what happens with the Buddhist path is that there comes a point when you internalize these teachings 100%. You become these teachings. Yeah, they become part of your psychology. They become part of who you are. You can't avoid practicing these things anymore. How do you know that someone is an arahant? You know it through their conduct, because they are kind, they are compassionate, they are understanding, they have all the right qualities. They can't be in any other way. Of course, if you can't be in any other way, it means you don't have to grasp onto the teachings anymore, because they are part of you. Yeah, that's why you can stop, you can lay it aside. Laying it aside, not grasping here, doesn't mean you stop doing those things. It means that they become a natural part of you. So it is important to see these things in the right way, because otherwise you think that this is like a teaching for how we should live, how we should act. Not really. It's not a teaching about how we should act. It's a teaching about the results of the practice. The result of the practice is that you stop grasping. It is not a teaching about stop grasping straight away. If you do that, you misunderstand and you can't actually move forward on the path. So hold on to the virtue a little bit. Yeah, don't think you can just discard it straight away. Hold on to the retreats a little bit. Hold on to the kindness and all these kind of things. And as you do so, that is the holding on that eventually leads to the letting go of all holding. Yeah. The craving that leads to the end of craving. The desire that leads to the end of desire. The attachment that leads to the end of attachment. That needs to be. So these things always have to be there. Not always. In the beginning, they have to be there. Gradually, you let go of them. Yeah. So that is the right way of thinking about the simile of the raft, and thinking about the path. So it is a gradual movement away from these things. So if you don't, if what I say isn't quite clear or whatever, please ask questions later on. You can put them in the basket outside, and then we can hopefully clarify anything which isn't quite right, any lacking in clarity or whatever. So that is that little sutta, and I will now go on to the next sutta. This sutta is called the City, and this is from the Nidana Sanyutta. And again, it gives a little bit of kind of background to the idea of the Noble Eightfold Path. There's only a couple of more suttas, and then tomorrow we'll get started on the Noble Eightfold Path properly here. So this sutta goes as follows. At Savati, before my awakening, while I was still a bodhisattva, not yet fully awakened, it occurred to me. Alas, this world has fallen into trouble, in that it is born, grows old, and dies. It passes away and is reborn, yet it does not understand the escape from this suffering, from this old age and death. When now will an escape be discerned from this suffering, from this old age and death? So here is the Buddha, not the Buddha yet, the Buddha to be, before his awakening experience, and he's trying to find the path. He has already gone forth, yeah, obviously. He's now seeking for a solution to the problems of life, and that is what this is really all about, this idea of being a bodhisattva. So while we're here, it's always good, I think, to talk a little bit about the idea of the bodhisattva. Maybe you will be surprised to see the idea of bodhisattva here in the Pali Suttas. Many people think that the idea of bodhisattva is only found in Mahayana Buddhism. But here it is, yeah, in one of the early suttas. What is it doing there? Should it be there? Is it wrong? Has some evil Mahayana monk put it in there just to kind of confuse us? The answer is no. No evil Mahayana monk has done that. This actually is part and parcel of the early suttas. And the way that the word bodhisattva is used in the early suttas is always used about the Buddha after he leaves his home life, before he reaches his awakening. Yeah, in that period, when he's searching for awakening, that is the bodhisattva in the early suttas. So what is the actual meaning of this word? So often, the meaning of this word, or the Sanskrit version of this word, is said to be bodhisattva, and bodhisattva means something. Sattva is a being. Bodhi is awakening, yeah, so awakening being, which is maybe slightly strange, but there is an alternative understanding of this word, which I think is far superior, and that is it refers to the Sanskrit word bodhisakta, and sakta means someone who is intent on something, yeah, someone who is intent on awakening. And I think this is the right interpretation of the word bodhisattva, because in Pali it can have both meanings, because it can refer back to different Sanskrit origins. But actually, it seems to me much more likely to refer to someone who is intent on awakening. Why is that? Because when the Buddha started out in the home life, and you have some suttas about that, he looks at the world and he thinks exactly the sort of thought that you have here, yeah? Alas, the world has fallen into trouble. It is born, it grows old, it passes, it dies, it passes away and is reborn. This is the Buddha's understanding of the problems inherent in life. And then he wants to find a solution. He is intent on finding a solution. And that intention of finding a solution is what a bodhisattva is all about. Finding the awakening, finding the way out of the problem, finding some solution to the problems of life. Yeah, imagine the courage it would take to do that, to just go forth. I mean, in that society, of course, the idea of samanas, people going forth and just living in the forest, it already existed prior to the Buddha. But it's kind of magnificent when people do that. They understand there is a problem with life. Let's go forth and try to find a solution to this. There's something very noble and beautiful about that. And especially when there is no solution existing, you have to find everything out for yourself. It's quite impressive. So this is where the idea of bodhisattva originates from. It originates with the idea of the Buddha after his going forth. He leaves his home life until his awakening. Of course, later on in Buddhism, the idea of bodhisattva becomes very different. Yeah, after a while it starts to expand, and especially after the Buddha has passed away, one of the things that happens there is that people start to wonder, well, who was this Buddha? Yeah, who was with us for so long? And then they start to kind of maybe have a little bit of information, a little bit of invention, a little bit of whatever, and then the idea starts to expand and expand and expand. And that's how eventually you end up with ideas like the bodhisattva path that you have in Mahayana Buddhism, also in Theravada Buddhism, it's actually everywhere. And you have this idea of someone who has been striving on the path for 4 incalculable eons and 100,000 eons or something like that, trying to become a Buddha in this life. That is how that eventually, what it turns into eventually, out of, I think, partly out of imagination, partly out of grief for the loss of the Buddha, partly out of bits and pieces of information that remains in the suttas, concocted together, and then you make this quite magnificent idea of the Buddha practicing for so long. But the point is, and this is kind of the interesting thing, is that in the suttas, the Buddha says quite clearly that he too is blind. Yeah, this is what we will see later on. He doesn't really know what he's doing here. He's kind of fumbling around in the dark, practicing austerities, saying that he has wrong view, having problems with defilements, just like everyone else. So he wasn't really practicing a path. He was just fumbling around. The point is there is no Bodhisattva path. Now, this is where he discovers the path. The awakening experience is the actual discovery of the path to awakening. Prior to that, he is also fumbling around just like everyone else. When you see a sutta like the Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya number 82, the Buddha talks about his meeting of the previous Buddha Kassapa. Yeah, and the way he talks about the Buddha Kassapa is not very nice. He says, that shaveling ascetic, what do they know? They know nothing. Yeah, that, it's in the suttas. It almost sounds like, ooh, what's going on here? And it shows you that the Buddha-to-be, prior to his awakening, he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know what the Dhamma was. He didn't know the path. He didn't understand what was happening here. So this is the original idea of the idea of Bodhisattva. Don't be taken on board by the idea of a Bodhisattva path, because there is no such path. It just happens every now and again that somebody breaks through to awakening here, more or less by luck, by having the right circumstances, the right society around them that encourages this kind of thing. The right circumstances coming together, then somebody is able to break through their good qualities. And that is really how it happens. So don't try to be a Buddha. It's good enough to be an arahant, If you are... If you become an arahant and you're not happy with that, okay, then, maybe... usually arahant people are plenty happy with that. So see what happens. Anyway, this is the way I look at these suttas, and I think that this is... when you read the early suttas, it's quite clear this actually is the right way of thinking about them. So, then the Buddha is the Buddha-to-be trying to find an escape from suffering. He's seeing all the problems in life. And then he says, and then there's a long sutta in between, which I have taken out because it's all about dependent origination. And I don't really want to get too much into dependent origination on this retreat, although we can talk about it a little bit if you want to. We'll see what happens. And then at the end of that, the Buddha says, it occurred to me, I have discovered this path to awakening. That is, with the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the six sense bases. With the cessation of the six sense bases, the cessation of contact. And then all the way up, stage by stage, through all the links of dependent origination, until such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. The Buddha has discovered the way to the end of suffering. He has seen the path, and he has seen, understood dependent origination. How, when you take away the root cause of dependent origination, which is avidya, which is delusion, misunderstanding of reality, take that away, the whole thing ceases as a consequence. Suffering comes to an end. Cessation, cessation. Thus, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, insight, and light. The Buddha has seen the truth of how suffering ceases. And then comes this beautiful simile of that the Buddha, how the Buddha talks about this, how he actually kind of makes this, enriches this idea. Suppose a man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. He would follow it and he would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a royal minister, "Sire, know that while wandering through the forest, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. I followed it and I saw an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Renovate that city, sire. Then the king or the royal minister would renovate the city, and sometime later that city would become successful and prosperous, well-populated, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. So too, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road, traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past. And when I saw that ancient path, that ancient road, and what is that ancient path? It is this noble eightfold path that is right view, right aim, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. I follow that path, and by doing so, I have directly known old age and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. I have directly known birth, existence, taking up or attachment, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, consciousness, and intentional activities, their origin, their cessation, and the way leading to their cessation. Having directly known them, I have explained them to the monks, the nuns, the male lay followers, and the female lay followers. This holy life has become successful and prosperous, extended, popular, widespread, well proclaimed among devas and humans. So this is the Buddha's expression of what he has discovered. Yeah, this marvelous thing, walking through the forest, wandering through the forest, perhaps even roaming through the forest, yeah, not really knowing where you're going. What is this forest? And the forest is very often in the suttas, I think, a metaphor for the sensual world in particular. Yeah, when you are in the forest, especially if you are in a real jungle like you have in the tropical countries, when you go to Sri Lanka or you go to Indonesia and you go to the faraway places, it's really thick. Yeah, you can't see very far ahead. You can see a few meters ahead. Yeah, and you can't really see much further because the forest is so thick in these places. So you're wandering around kind of aimlessly, not knowing where you're going. And the sensual world is like that, because as long as you are immersed in sensuality, as long as you are immersed in attachment and craving for all of these things, it's like your mind is limited. You can't see very far. Your mind is obstructed and constrained by these sensual things. They say in the suttas, your mind is small, limited. But when you get rid of the sensuality, when you move above the canopy of this forest, yeah, you have this in the suttas by getting on the mountaintop above the forest. It's like your mind being freed and released from the sensuality of the world, the five hindrances. Going above that, getting an overview, understanding what is going on. Your mind is unlimited, is expanded, no longer contracted or obstructed by these five hindrances and sensuality in particular. Yeah, so you wander through this forest, and one day, while you live in the sensual world, you come across this ancient path. It's a beautiful idea of an ancient path. The path is always there. The Noble Eightfold Path is something which always exists. It's just a matter of finding it. Yeah, we are very lucky because someone has already found it for us. The Buddha found it for us, and he tells us, here's the path on the plate, practice it. And we try our best to practice it, and we kind of go a little bit forward, two steps forward, one step back, you know, trying to move on this path. And it's difficult enough to be a disciple. But here you have this extraordinary being, and this is what makes the Buddha so special, the fact that he was able to find this path on his own without having a teacher to show him. So he finds this ancient path. Why is it ancient? Because it is always there, because it has been found also by other Buddhas in the past. And this is what makes, one of the things that makes Buddhism such a, in my opinion, again, inspiring teaching. Because it's not about one Buddha which arises just at the right time for us, yeah? And this is the only Buddha ever. No, the Buddha is the Buddhism or the Dhamma is a recurring teaching which is discovered at regular intervals or irregular intervals. Every now and again, somebody discovers this path, finds it, and teaches it to the whole world. A Buddha arises again. And of course, the same thing will also happen in the future. You rediscover this ancient path, which is always there. And there's this kind of, you look at it from a cosmic point of view, it makes really good sense. Yeah, it is not just an individual thing and we happen to be very lucky. It is part of the order of the cosmos that occasionally somebody arises who is able to see through the delusion, the veil of the world, the cloud, the mist of reality, which is so hard to see through. A Buddha arises and then teaches it to others. And it makes far better sense, yeah, that it's not something that is unique to us, but something that actually happens with regular intervals. That is when these teachings, in my opinion, really come together and make sense. So the Buddha is just one in a large, large sequence of Buddhas in the past and then also coming back again in the future. And at this point, people say, yeah, okay, they're coming in the future, yeah. What is it called? Yeah, Maitreya Buddha, right? There's one sutta that talks about Maitreya Buddha. It's only one sutta. Please keep that in mind. One place, they say Maitreya Buddha. Now, if you take that sutta and you compare it to the Chinese version of the sutta, no Maitreya in the Chinese version of the sutta. That makes you suspicious. Maybe if there's only one occurrence, and that occurrence is a little bit iffy, then maybe this whole idea of Maitreya Buddha is worth not taking too seriously. Because often you hear people saying, yeah, I'll just hang out, you know, a Buddha, they can give me the real teaching, they can read my mind, give me exactly the teaching that I need. So it would be so easy for me. Yeah, they will say, you do this and that, and then you will become enlightened. But it doesn't work like that. Yeah, it is not as simple as that. You just wait for the Buddha to come around. That is, in my opinion, a very big mistake that people sometimes do. And it's very common these days in the Buddhist world to hear this kind of expression, this way of thinking about the Buddhist path. I'm going to wait for Maitreya to come around because then I can really practice the path so much more easily. Please don't think like that. Because Maitreya Buddha is so uncertain, don't know when he or she is going to come around. Yeah, just no, absolutely no idea. Don't know how far in the future it's going to be. Don't know where it's going to be. You don't know if you're going to be a human being if Maitreya is it. Maybe you are reborn in some very bad realm or very good realm, and you're out of reach from the Buddha. And even if you are reborn as a human being, maybe you are a Christian at that time. Yeah. and the Buddha teaches you and you say, oh, no, I believe in the Creator God. Yeah, so there's no, you know, they can't be converted because your strength of faith in the Creator God is so strong. You know what it's like if you try to convert a Christian? Yeah, it doesn't work. You can't do that. They are kind of committed to the Creator God. Or you are like the Buddha Gautama, who when he goes and sees the previous Buddha, yeah, he dismisses him like, no, he doesn't know anything. That shaven-headed kind of, you know, ascetic, you know, the offspring of Brahma's feet is what they call the Samanas. You know, the offspring of Brahma's feet, yeah? In India, Brahma, the supreme deity, yeah? And the Brahmins were like the sons of Brahma. They considered themselves the highest, that's why they were the highest caste. And they were born of Brahma's mouth. Yeah, because Brahma's mouth is like that. That's where the Vedas get expressed through the Brahma's mouth. So they were born from the highest part of Brahma. And then the various different castes, they were born on different levels of Brahma. Some like kind of, you know, chest tight, some waist tight. And then the worst ones were the Samanas. The Samanas are those people who go forth, like the Buddha who live in the forest. That was the absolute worst. They were born of the soles of Brahma's feet. Yeah, the dirtiest part of the body. You walk around barefoot. So this is kind of the expression. And this is kind of the words that the Buddha to be used when he expressed, when he talked about Kassapa Buddha. He says, these offsprings of Brahma's feet. Yeah, what do they know? And so it's really kind of bad. Yeah, this is what you have to see here. So remember that just because we know, in a sense, that there will be future Buddhas, it doesn't mean that you can just chill. Yeah. Okay, I can just chill then. I wait for the Buddha to come around. It doesn't mean that at all. It means that now you have the opportunity. Now you have been reborn in the right place. Now you have access to the Buddha's teachings. Now the Buddha Gautama teaching is still here. Now is the chance to do something. And even if you don't make a full end of the Buddhist path in this life, at the very least, you have gone as far as you possibly can. Yeah, you have tried to meditate, you tried to be kind and generous, done all the right things. At the very least, you have gone as far as you can. And that gives you a kind of a bit of an advantage in the future, in your next life, and even down the line. So remember, now is the opportunity. Don't miss the opportunity when the teachings are here. It's completely the wrong idea to think that we should wait for some kind of future pie in the sky that we have no idea about. Yeah, that is really the idea of Buddha Maitreya. So although it is an ancient path, and although you have all these ancient Buddhas having walked in the past, it is really our Buddha Gautama that we have to thank for having the teachers now, having these teachings now. And he is the person that we should really respect for passing these teachings on. If we start worshipping Maitreya Buddha, we are actually, I think, disrespecting Buddha Gautama, who really gave us these teachings. And we're getting things the wrong way around. So, and then, of course, you follow that path and you come to this ancient city, the ancient capital, which has all these parks and groves and ponds and ramparts, a delightful place. Yeah, and this is really an expression of the results of the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, all the wonderful things that happen as a consequence of practicing this path. And you will have noticed probably already in your own life, if you have been practicing for a while, how the Dhamma actually gradually transforms you. How gradually you become more together, you get more clarity, you become more kind, gradually, gradually, gradually. And as you do that, the parks and groves become more and more beautiful until one day, bang, yeah, Nibbana, and you see the groves and the parks in the full splendor. And that is what attaining Nibbana is all about. And then the inhabitants in this park, well, these are really the Aryas of the world. These are the inhabitants who live in this park. And the king and the royal ministers, these are perhaps the first disciples of the Buddha. They go and clear up that park. They become enlightened first, and then they bring other people along the path by being teachers and by themselves practicing in the right way. Yeah, it's a very beautiful simile, I think, in so many ways, this idea of this ancient path through the forest. And then the Buddha says, I too saw that ancient path traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past. Yeah, the same Buddhas in the past. Once you have insight into this path, you know that everyone who is enlightened must have actually traveled on exactly the same path. This is the path. This is the way that awakening happens. It doesn't happen any other way. The Noble Eightfold Path, es eva maggo natti anyo, this is the path. There is no other, as it says in the Dhammapada. Why? Because you have to purify the mind, yeah? And through that purification of the mind, only then is it possible to have insight. And if you think about it, actually it's very obvious that that must be the case. Because a mind which is clouded by defilements cannot possibly see clearly. I think you all know that already to some extent. The more clear the mind is, the more deep will that insight will be here. So all these Bhagavas, all these ancient ones in the past, also traveled that ancient path. What is that ancient path? Of course, the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is what you're going to be studying, or I'm going to be studying it too, by the way, during this retreat, this ancient path in the forest. Doesn't that sound kind of exciting here? Yeah, ancient path in the forest, going through the jungle, coming to this magnificent city on the other end. Yeah, sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds very attractive. So this is what we're going to try to do, try to kind of clarify what that path is, see if we can get a little bit of a glimpse of that city at the other end, what it looks like. So every time you have a little bit of happiness and joy in your meditation practice, if you get to that, you're getting like the very first inkling, yeah, of what this is about, moving in the right direction towards that. One of the things that is interesting about this, is really a side issue, I'm not sure if I should go there at all, but one of the interesting things here is, well, what is the Buddha actually referring to here? What is this ancient city? Was there an ancient city in India at that time that he's actually referring to? And if you know a little bit about the history of India, you will know that about 1,000, or just over 1,000 years prior to the Buddha, there was the ancient Indus Valley civilization, yeah, which died out about 1,700 BCE. And it's possible that this actually refers to that ancient Indus Valley civilization, because usually a simile will be based on some sort of reality. Yeah, and there may still have been some remnants of that memory of those ancient Indus Valley civilizations. I'm just trying to tie history together a little bit here to what is going on. Because remember, the suttas are real. Yeah, these suttas are historical documents. These are things that actually happened. This becomes very clear when you travel to India and you see the places in the suttas and you see that they are exactly the same now as they were 2,500 years ago. So when you can tie it a little bit into history, including the Indus Valley civilization perhaps, it makes them more real in many ways. These are real people. The Buddha was a real person. he's not just a fiction or a character who seems kind of, you know, seems like a nice guy. That's kind of being a bit disrespectful, isn't it? Who seems like an extraordinary person in the suttas. These are real people. These things actually really happened. So get your head around that. It makes it much, much more interesting, in my opinion, here. So he finds the right eightfold path, and by following that path, then he understands dependent origination, which is that profound insight into how delusion and craving are the sources of suffering. And by eliminating those sources of delusion and craving, you then abandon suffering completely as a consequence. And then he explains this to the monks, the nuns, the male lay followers, and the female lay followers. And then the holy life, the brahmacharya, becomes successful and prosperous, extended, popular, widespread, well proclaimed among devas and humans. Okay, so there you are. That is the sutta for couple of suttas for now. We will leave that aside for now, and then we will meet you again. Is it 7:30? 7:30, Anna? 8 o'clock, is it? Are you sure? Yeah. Okay. We'll meet whatever the schedule says we're supposed to meet. We will meet back again here later on. And then we will continue with the Q&A. So if you have any questions about everything I have said, please ask. Don't be afraid of asking questions. Please just say nice things to me. Don't say you dodgy monk or anything like that, because then I become really upset. So say nice things to me, and then I'm very happy to answer almost anything. Okay. Is it? Yeah, didn't that one have the guided meditation at 7:30 or something? Yeah. We just follow the schedule. Makes it easier.